Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Governor Tom Wolf is being sworn in today for his second term. While campaigning before last November's election, the governor and supporters touted his accomplishments and opponents, opponents were sure to point out where they thought that Wolf had stumbled. So as Governor Wolf takes the oath of office today, we look back at that first term in terms of taxes and revenue and what to expect in the second with Ed Mahan, reporter for PA Post, who has written about the first term and what's coming up this week. So, Ed, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ed, when Tom Wolf ran for governor the first time 4 years ago, when it comes to taxes, what did he talk about doing?
One of the big things was changing the personal income tax system. Pennsylvania has a flat income tax. It's about 3.07%, so everybody pays that rate no matter how much you make. And he wanted to make a progressive income tax, which is what the federal government has. The more you earn, that your rate increases with that. That was one of the big campaign focuses. He got a lot of questions about it because there's questions about whether that's constitutional in Pennsylvania. And he also wanted the severance tax on natural gas drilling.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the income tax first. First of all, the governor, obviously, this is something that the governor proposes, the legislature has to approve, yeah, and then eventually it's signed into law by the governor if the legislature does approve. Both of those that you mentioned, the personal income tax increase and a severance tax on natural gas drillers, the legislature did not approve.
No, and even with the personal income tax, so he campaigned on it, but when he got into office, he shifted focus. He dropped that idea. I think over some of the constitutional concerns. And so instead, in his first budget, he proposed a big change to the tax system that would have raised income taxes, raised sales taxes, and expanded what was covered. But he said he was going to reduce property taxes, and that's sort of where the progressive idea would come from, that you create a more fair property tax system and you sort of leave the income tax system the same. He also wanted to reduce the corporate net income tax for Pennsylvania, which is one of the highest.
9.9%. Yeah, I think it's the first or second highest in the country.
Depending on how you measure. And so in his first budget address, he proposed this giant change to the tax system in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. But
it didn't happen.
Let me take a step back. You know, a lot of governors, when they first become governor, they have big ideas. Governor Wolf was proposing some massive changes in Pennsylvania tax structure, and with that came revenue. What was the governor looking for? What kind of revenue was he looking for at that point? What was he looking to pay for?
You know, the big thing he was looking to pay for was education funding increases. I think it was about $2 billion the first, over time is what he was looking for. And that was another big campaign promise, and that was what he focused on. That was sort of all that movement was. There are other reasons for it, but the big thing was education funding.
And again, this is kind of a history lesson, and I think that's one of the things you can take from Ed's story in PA Post, is it reminds us where we were, and eventually we'll talk about where we may be. Mm-hmm. But you remember former Governor Corbett, that one of the big criticisms was that he had cut education funding by $1 billion.
That's right.
Now, if you provide context to that, it is that when the stimulus, federal stimulus during the 2008, recession that we had, that the federal government had provided stimulus money, Pennsylvania got $1 billion, was applied toward education. Schools and all that were told, don't count on this money. This is a one-time deal. And so when the money went away, it wasn't replaced. But when Governor Corbett ran for re-election against Governor Wolf, now Governor Wolf, his opponents would say he cut education funding by $1 billion. Yeah. I guess technically you could say that is correct, but you have to provide that context.
Yeah, and it's complicated too. The school districts, they had increased pension spending,
right,
too, and the state helped with that. And also, there's that $1 billion or so, but then where they did actually decide to cut it, matters. So that there was charter school funding that wasn't stimulus money, but that got cut. And so, it's a big pot of money. and some of it is not. Some of it is, you know, split up in ways that hurt some people more than others.
Well, yeah, that plus, I mean, there were a lot of school districts where teachers, for example, were laid off or furloughed. So, even though the schools were told don't count on that money, you know, when you're hurting for money, as most school districts in this state are, you're going to jump on that and do what you can because you don't want to raise property taxes. All right, so getting back to Governor Wolf and what he promised, what he was looking for. When he was campaigning last year, you heard Republicans, his opponent Scott Wagner say, and others, that he was asking for the biggest tax increase in the history of the state. If I remember correctly, they said it was $3.5 billion. Is that accurate?
I guess what I'd have to go back and check that.
The number.
There was a tax shift. There were things going on. I don't have that right in front of me to say whether that was accurate or not. Mm-hmm. But I mean that was in that first budget. There was a large tax increase involved in addition to some of the shifting.
So let's talk about what did pass and what didn't.
So in that first budget, you know, they had that stalemate for a long, long time.
Nine months,
and then so. No big tax changes happened in that budget, but in this 2016-17, they sort of what they've managed to do and what they've managed to agree on is a number of targeted tax increases. There's a Keystone Research Center, more liberal group say it, you know, they view it as they've muddled through and just found, and the conservative group sort of thinks the same thing.
Commonwealth Foundation.
They've muddled through. They found money where they could. They've transferred money from funds, and then they've sort of selected some of these areas that they can agree on to tax. So, what some of the things they did is, the big one was cigarette tax that went up by $1 a pack for most of the state. They taxed vaping, and so that was a big tax of 40%. The industry says that dozens upon dozens of businesses had to close because of that tax, and then they also expanded taxing for loose tobacco, for like chewing tobacco and roll your own tobacco. So that's where they got a lot of money for spending, which was from that like hundreds of millions of dollars each year from that tobacco taxes. Mm-hmm. They've also, you might notice this if you get your iTunes receipt, the digital downloads. It used to be not taxed in Pennsylvania, but now it is. So if you bought the Star Wars on a DVD, you would pay a sales tax on it. But if you bought it online, you wouldn't. If you bought it online and just had it uploaded through the cloud or whatever, then you wouldn't pay the sales tax. Now you do pay the sales tax on that. And then there was a tax on banks that went up a little bit. And then the Pennsylvania lottery income, which not many people, I guess some people do win the lottery, but when you think about winning the lottery,
it doesn't affect a lot of people.
Yeah, it's that was not subject to the personal income tax before, but now it is subject to it.
Yeah, a lot of people always have questions about that because lottery winnings were subject to federal tax, but for the first time they are subject to state taxes as well. So what does the governor say about the taxes that did get approved?
When I asked him about this at a news conference last week, and he sort of downplayed the significance of some of them. He talked about the cigarette tax is mostly a way of stopping people from smoking. Didn't really talk about the money it brought in. And then on the other things, he described it as sort of an approach to modernize the economy, to keep pace with other states, or to as sort of like technical changes is how he described them. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you're paying the taxes, you might not see them necessarily as technical changes.
Mm-hmm. What about Republicans? I mean, you talked about that 9 month stalemate. We're talking about the budget, the first budget that was proposed by the governor. It took 9 months before Pennsylvania actually had a budget. Republicans, many vowed, many had even, in fact, former Governor Corbett had signed a pledge not to increase taxes. But as you just described, there were tax increases that Republicans, since Republicans are in the majority in the House and the Senate, had to approve.
Yeah, and so the Republicans, they generally like to say that, they got in the way of Wolf increasing the personal income tax rates and raising the sales tax rates. I reached out to their caucus spokespeople for this story, and they sort of echoed some of the sort of technical changes that, that Star Wars example, the DVD versus online, came from the Senate caucus spokesperson. But I mean, so one of the reasons we did the story is because, you know, these are things both sides agreed upon. So these aren't the things that they're hitting each other over. You know, these are so we wanted to, you know, highlight to readers what the actual impact is of some of these changes. And there are other changes too that passed. I mean, some of the things were, you know, they made fireworks. They expanded what kind of fireworks you could have in Pennsylvania. But they also added like a 12% tax on those fireworks. Mm-hmm. So things like that. So you might not be too angry about a fireworks tax because you didn't have them before, but now you do.
You mentioned that there were some changes, or at least the governor proposed changes in taxes that would impact businesses. The corporate net income tax, 9.9%. I think that both Republicans and Democrats feel that's too high.
Yeah, everybody hates
that. But nothing has changed there. But there was one tax that was very unpopular with businesses that was repealed. The capital stock and franchise tax.
Yeah.
Now, this thing has been in the works for the last 20 years almost.
Yeah, I think a tax dates back to like the 1840s, something about around there. And then so Governor Ridge, he passed legislation in 2000 to get rid of the capital stock and franchise tax and to phase it in over a period of time. And then it kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed. And then the last time it was delayed was under Governor Corbett. He delayed the elimination of it, and then so it was set to expire at the end of 2015, and that was in the middle of the big budget stalemate. And Wolf didn't propose; he proposed keeping that, letting it expire as is, and then it expired as is with no action. And so he says he's the one who finished the job. You know, some people might think that you didn't really have to. He didn't do anything to get rid of it. It just went away. But
what is
a course of action, you know. Yeah.
Just for context, what was that tax on? It was a business tax called a capital stock and franchise tax. And unless you owned a business, for the most part, you probably didn't understand what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think the business community just viewed it as like sort of a tack on tax, like an extra tax on in addition to the corporate net income tax. That it wasn't, you know, specifically targeted or anything like that. It was just a sort of a general business tax.
What about gambling and other taxes?
Yeah, and so one of the ways Democrats and Republicans and Governor Wolf, you know, agreed on, you know, because they have gotten education funding increases, not to the same degree as Governor Wolf originally proposed, but they have gotten, you know, a lot, hundreds of millions more dollars for education funding, in addition to other things. And so gambling, they've approved a number of gambling expansions. So there's kind of, you know, all these mini casinos they're talking about popping up across the state. And then there's going to be these video gaming terminals at truck stops, as long as the counties, I think, allow it. And that comes with a big tax on those gaming terminals as well. So that's another area where, you know, they're giving consumers more choices, and with that, they're bringing taxes. It's not, you know, taxing something that's already here, so you don't get the same sort of anger over it, you know.
Gasoline taxes. Pennsylvania has the highest tax on gasoline in the country. This was something that was started in the previous administration, but what does Governor Wolf say about it?
So Governor Wolf, you know, back in 2013, big transportation bill, I think like, you know, a few billion dollars every year in funding. And with that came the gas tax increase. During the 2014 campaign, Wolf, at one point, he criticized Corbett for raising your gas taxes through the roof, were his words. But he's also, at the same time, was pretty positive about that transportation bill. And since he's been in office, the final phase of that gas tax increase went through. So this was something that this is a tax increase they didn't stop. They didn't take any action to pass it, but they didn't stop it from going through. And so he's defended that gas tax as, you know, necessary for a lot of these bridge projects, a lot of these road improvements. And, you know, people in Pennsylvania, some make the argument that we are more reliant on the gas tax than other states, but also those other states tax other things that we don't.
And there may be some changes coming down the road because we understand that, you know, in the future, there will be automobiles that won't be as reliant on gasoline.
That's true.
And so Pennsylvania may have to make some changes for that reliance on the gas tax. We have a call from Art in Wrightsville. Art, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm talking about the capital stock franchise tax.
Yes.
The that tax was imposed as it goes back 100 years. When 100 years ago, you couldn't get a franchise for business in perpetuity. It was only for about 30 years, and then you'd have to go back to the state legislature for a renewal. And that's how state legislatures kept control of companies. You know, if they didn't do something they didn't like, well, they just wouldn't renew the charter. So Rockefeller didn't like that, and so he searched for a state that would give him a charter in perpetuity, and that happened to be New Jersey. So he said, look, you get a, we'll pay a capital stock franchise tax, and it'll be enough that you can eliminate the real estate tax in New Jersey. Well, New Jersey jumped on that. But once New Jersey went, then all the states went.
Huh.
So that tax is really a payment for charter in perpetuity. So China only gives you a 30-year charter, and that's why a lot of American companies are in trouble, because China can basically not renew their charter, and every asset they have is reverts to the state.
Hey,
so that's what that tax buys companies.
Hey, Art,
charter in perpetuity.
Thank you very much for the call. I love the history.
Yeah.
Love the history. I mean,
so New Jersey doesn't have any property taxes now, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
that's stuck around.
Nobody
does. Promise agreed. No, I think they have really high property taxes.
Yeah, I think they have the highest in the country.
Yeah.
Okay, so just a few more minutes. And how does Pennsylvania compare with other states after all these tax changes?
You know, so they've tweaked things, and they haven't been huge tax changes in PA. So, I mean, when you look at the organization, the Tax Foundation, which is a national organization, they have lots of data. They're generally, you know, more critical of tax increases, but they have lots of good data about them. They put Pennsylvania's overall business tax climate in, like, the ranking 34 in the nation. They, you know, generally are individual tax rate for a person is relatively low. Sales tax rate, they put it in like the 21, but the corporate tax, they put it, you know, in the bottom 10 essentially.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good if you're a person, worse for a business. And our property taxes, they put that relatively in the middle of the pack as well.
So Ed, as Governor Wolf is sworn in for his second term today, when we're talking about taxes and revenue, what can we expect? I mean, you mentioned the severance tax, that the governor has said that he will continue to ask for a severance tax on natural gas. But what else?
I know they're expected to have a budget deficit for the upcoming budget, about $1.7 billion, according to some estimates. I think Governor Wolf has, you know, he's said he doesn't intend to raise the personal income tax, doesn't intend to raise the sales tax or push for that. I think you could, over the next 4 years, look for some of these targeted areas, these things that, you know, these sales tax expansions in small areas as sort of might be agreed to behind closed doors.
You mean the kind of thing that isn't taxed in Pennsylvania today?
Yeah, like the sales tax, things that aren't taxed. And you know, you can make the case for why they should be, like lottery winnings or for the income, or sales tax for digital downloads. You can make the case for why they're fair to tax, but they don't usually make the case until they really need the money, and then they're interested in going after that kind of thing. But I mean, Governor Wolf has, you know, he's said he doesn't want to raise personal income or sales taxes. So, I mean, you look for the severance tax, you look for fees. I think he has pushed before for sort of coverage fees for people for towns that don't have their own police departments that get state police funding.
And a lot of that goes back to the transportation
funding.
That a lot of that money that was supposed to go toward transportation actually has gone for paying for state police coverage in those municipalities that don't have their own police departments. You can read more about this at PA Post. Ed Mahan's story is online right now. Ed, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The partial shutdown of the federal government is almost a month long now. Much of the attention so far has been on federal workers who aren't getting paid and missed their first paycheck last week. But the further the shutdown continues, the more people who will be affected. Pennsylvanians who rely on Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, or SNAP, for food will be impacted. The State Department of Human Services says that SNAP recipients will get their benefits for February early. Joining us to tell us more about it is Pennsylvania's Department of Human Services Secretary Teresa Miller. Secretary Miller, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary Miller, so what exactly is happening this week?
Yeah, so we issued a press release yesterday notifying Pennsylvanians that February benefits for SNAP, for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or what a lot of people might know of as food stamps, those recipients will be getting their February benefits dispersed on January 18th, so this coming Friday, and then they'll be available for them to use on Saturday on the 19th. But this all came about because on January 8th, my agency, DHS, received a notice from the United States Department of Agriculture that February SNAP benefits would be fully funded, but that those benefits needed to be issued by January 20th. So we immediately began working really closely with our vendors and were pleased to find out that we would be able to issue the February benefits to EBT cards on January 18th.
Why by January 20th, did they explain?
So my understanding from the USDA is that there was a provision in the continuing resolution that expired, of course, that caused the shutdown, that provided for appropriation for programs like SNAP to continue operations within 30 days of the continuing resolution's expiration. So 30 days following essentially the shutdown, they could continue to incur obligations for these programs' operations. So that's why January 20th becomes the key date to get those benefits out, and that's why they're asking states to get these benefits for February out by the 20th of January.
So how many Pennsylvanians are we talking about?
Well, in any given month, we've got about a 1.8 million Pennsylvanians that receive SNAP. So this will have an impact on millions of Pennsylvanians.
Yeah, that's significant when you talk about a population of 13 million people and almost 2 million of them will be impacted by this. Now,
exactly.
Even though, you know, on the surface, when you hear that these benefits will be available early, there's a but to that. And that is that this is for February,
right.
But there's nothing appropriated for March, correct?
Well, that's true. So what we know now is that we will have funds for February, although I think one tricky thing is that, you know, individuals who receive SNAP are used to getting their benefits sometime at the beginning of the month, and that's what they use to purchase food or at least supplement purchasing food for the rest of that month. Now they're going to be getting those benefits a few weeks early, and they've got to make them last through the month of February. In terms of March, payments beyond February are going to be determined based on the availability of USDA funds. The USDA has indicated that there's some funding that will remain to partially cover March benefits, but it's unclear at this point how far into March that will actually cover us. And that's because they have some reserve funding. I think the USDA has indicated they have about $3 billion in reserve. And that's it. So once that money's gone, which will be gone sometime in March, that's all there is.
So when you're asking 1.8 million people to make this stretch.
Exactly.
I mean, that's fairly tough. I mean, when you think about it.
It is. We all have our budgets for the month that we figure out how to pay all of our bills within. And, you know, I know for me, when you get a paycheck at a different time or you've got bills that are due at different times or a bill you didn't expect, it certainly, you know, causes some concern and anxiety. And, you know, this is going to be different. And part of what we want to do is make sure we're getting the message out, because we certainly don't want people to think that this payment that is going to show up on our EBT cards is a bonus payment or somehow extra money. We really want to make sure everyone understands that that payment is your February payment. You're not going to get another payment on your regularly scheduled February payment date. So that's got to cover you through February, which we're certain is going to cause some concern by a lot of folks. But
as I said in the introduction, Secretary, Most of the attention, at least from the media and from the federal government, I think, so far has been on federal workers who many of them have been furloughed, but there are also many others who continue to work and are not being paid for it. They missed their first paycheck last week. Now, as we are in day 26 of this shutdown, we are finding more areas, more people that may be impacted by the federal shutdown. In your department, in Human Services, Department of Human Services across Pennsylvania, other than SNAP, are there other areas where Pennsylvanians are being impacted by this?
Not yet. So, you know, Medicaid is not impacted by the federal government shutdown because the Department of Health and Human Services is fully funded with a couple of exceptions. But at this point, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is really the only place where we're starting to see impacts. Now, if this shutdown continues, you know, we may see other areas impacted, but this is kind of the first most immediate impact.
Off the top of your head, can you tell us what some of those other areas are? I mean, I hate to alarm people, but it is good to know of some other areas where there may be an impact.
Well, so the exceptions in the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal Department of Health and Human Services, the exceptions in terms of the no impact by the federal government shutdown would be TANF, or Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, and the child care subsidies. But we do have excess prior year funding that will carry us for a while. So we don't want to alarm people in other areas where we don't need to at this point, but those are areas certainly that down the road could be impacted. But right now, you know, SNAP is the big issue, and we're just very, very hopeful that the federal government will come to a resolution so that we don't see further impacts to potentially millions of Pennsylvanians through these programs.
You know, Secretary, I can't help but think when about families that are trying to plan for the essentials like food, but the time of year that it is, I mean, let's face it, this week we're having some of the coldest temperatures, talking about the possibility of a winter storm coming. I think about a low-income heating assistance program.
Right.
It is, again, I've heard some people say after your announcement yesterday that there may be families in this state that will have to make a choice between food, heating, medication, all those kind of things. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what this is coming to, right? Because if people are going to be getting these February benefits early and struggling to have those benefits last further than they otherwise would have to last, we know that people struggle to make their current benefits last the whole month today. But you pay those early and then force people to make those payments last even longer. I do expect we're going to see more families struggling with, do I pay my utility bill? Do I pay my doctor's bill? Do I get food and buy food to put on my family's table? So I do think that's what we're talking about. So I think you're right. There's been a lot of media attention on the impact to federal government employees, which is really important. They obviously are significantly impacted. But this is starting to impact a lot more than just federal government employees. We're talking about millions of Pennsylvanians who may struggle in February more than they typically do to put food on their tables and pay all their other bills.
Pennsylvania's Secretary of the Department of Human Services, Teresa Miller. Secretary Miller, welcome, or I should say, thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me and getting this message out.
Thank you. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're going to switch gears in for this portion of the program for you. Something, I don't know, you may not see it as a little bit lighter, but you'll find out in just a moment. But first, I want to tell you that coming up on tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel talks reform and some other topics that's coming up on tomorrow's program. healthcare, medicine, and how the afflicted are treated have changed a great deal in the last three centuries. How physicians treat their patients even 100 years ago is hardly recognizable today. Author Thomas Morris has written about some of the oddest medical conditions and treatments in his new book, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. Thomas Morris joins us on the phone now from his home in West London. Mr. Morris, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So this home in West London, I understand that there's a little bit of history there that where you're residing.
Yes, I'm speaking to you from what used to be the largest lunatic asylum in Europe. It was built in the 1830s. It used to be known as Hanwell Asylum. In fact, I'm standing in my living room, which is what used to be the women's ward of this enormous mental institution.
Now, did you choose that home on purpose, or did you find out about this afterwards?
No, found out about it afterwards. My wife bought the apartment here a few years ago, so that was a bit of a coincidence. But there's quite a lot of interesting history here. So given my chosen profession, it's an interesting place to live.
It really is. Let me tell our listeners that if you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You could send a comment or a question on email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, there are many stories in your book that are truly cringeworthy. In fact, I think you say it even on the cover of the book that there are some cringe-inducing stories in the book. So for our audience, consider that a warning. But it's not gratuitous. All your stories are taken from medical records. Why did you want to write this book?
Well, it started off when I was working on my previous book, which is a history of heart surgery. And part of the research that was involved in that book, I spent a lot of time in medical libraries reading old medical journals. And I was reading some of the time articles about how they used to treat heart disease in the 19th century. And what I found when I started reading these old journals is that there are these amazing little stories tucked in between, you know, rather more worthy articles about you know, the treatment of serious diseases. You find this really strange story about a man who'd swallowed a knife, or you'd find an odd story about somebody suffering from a really mysterious illness of some variety. And then there are these other really odd little tales of, say, a man from Chicago who claimed to have taught his infant son to swim underwater for up to 30 minutes at a time. So there are these just strange little anecdotes peppered through what are otherwise rather serious medical publications. So that's where the idea came from. I just started to collect these stories and keep them for my own entertainment.
And it is entertaining, I will say that. Before we get into a few of these stories, the reader can't help coming away thinking we have come a long way when it comes to medical science. But two treatments that seem to arise again and again throughout history is bleeding, that physicians would bleed patients when they had some type of illness. And the other is enemas, that they used enemas extensively. So what was the thinking behind bleeding patients? And I hate to even bring it up, but behind enemas as well.
Well, one of the things I was keen to get over in this book and in general is that however strange treatments may seem to us today, in their time there was often a very clear rationale behind the treatment. So bleeding, for instance, which goes back thousands of years. I mean, the ancient Greeks were doing it. In fact, it was being done in other parts of the world as well. But in Western medicine, the rationale behind bleeding was that the ancient Greeks believed that health was determined by a balance between four bodily fluids, or humours as they were known. And one of these four bodily fluids is blood. And a lot of illnesses were believed to be caused by an excess of blood, meaning that there was an imbalance as a result. And so the logical thing to do if you've got too much blood in your body is just to evacuate some of it. And that grew into quite a sophisticated and complex doctrine, which persisted right up until the turn of the 20th century. So even in the 1890s, there are articles in medical journals where older physicians are saying, we should hold on to bleeding. It's effective in certain cases. It's worth saying, actually, just in brief, that there are still a few conditions today where evacuating in excess of blood can be useful. I mean, they're quite specific things involving kidney failure and so on, but it is still done for some conditions. And as for enemas, this actually has some basis behind it, in fact, as well, which is that the tissues around the rectum are actually rather absorbent. It is quite an efficient way of getting drugs into the system. And in fact, it's not so much done in American and British medicine these days, but there are still a lot of doctors on the continent who will prescribe a suppository rather than a pill or an oral medicine. So, again, there's some reason behind it.
I'm curious, you mentioned the kidney disease, for example, and there was apparently some history of bleeding, for example, that it was successful in treating some illnesses. But did they overdo it? Did the physicians, was that their like turn to diagnosis, is that okay, or treatment, I should say, that, he's got a cold, he's got the flu, we're going to bleed the guy?
Well, yes, there was. I mean, there are obviously differences of degree here, and I suspect that for many patients who were just being given a couple of leeches, say, it probably wasn't making very much difference to them. It wasn't doing them any harm. Now, in fact, in the late 18th century in America, you have Benjamin Rush, who is a founding father as well as the nation's most prominent physician. And he was known in some quarters as the remorseless bleeder, because he actually said to his students, apparently, he said that you should bleed not by ounces and pints, but by pails and buckets and pails full. He thought that it should be used in cases of typhoid and in these incredibly serious epidemic diseases that were killing people in the thousands in the late 18th century. So that was one extreme of the whole regime, the doctrine of bleeding.
Well, in Benjamin Rush's defense, we had the author of a new biography on Benjamin Rush on the program a few months ago, that he is a pioneer when it comes to the treatment of mental illness, for example. And hopefully he didn't use bleeding when it came to treating mental illness at that point.
Absolutely. In fact, there's an interesting connection there, which is that Benjamin Rush, very much like the architect of the building that I'm talking to you from right now, believed very much in occupational therapy. So mental patients were allowed to pursue the trade which they had been trained in. So, yeah, absolutely. In other ways, he was definitely a great physician.
If you're just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is Thomas Morris, author of the book, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. In the book, your chapters are broken down. And I'm going to talk about some of the stories, a few of the stories that you have. One in the very first chapter is called Unfortunate Predicaments. This one, I have to say that the way you wrote this, it not only is entertaining, but it is funny because you have direct quotes from the physicians, their medical journals, but then you also add your own editorial comment on some of these things, and that's what makes it entertaining and funny. But one that I found interesting was honking like a goose. What happened there?
Yeah, it's one of those stories that's kind of so extraordinary that you just know nobody could make it up. It's got to be true. It was a German physician who was called to, I think he practiced in a rural community, and he was told that there was a favorite pastime of the children in this particular area, which was that whenever a goose was slaughtered for eating, they like to take the larynx out of this goose and basically sort of blow through the throat of this goose to get the sort of honking noise that a goose would make in life. And this unfortunate child was playing with this goose larynx, and he managed to inhale it. And so when the doctor turned up to treat this child, he couldn't speak. And every time he opened his mouth and tried to speak, he just honked like a goose. Just a crazy injury. And, no harm befell him in the end. The doctor found a way of treating him. So it all ended well.
But there are a lot of cases where these things didn't end so well. But some of those unfortunate predicaments are very similar to what you just described, of people trying to do things that they probably shouldn't have done, and it hurts them in the end. Other examples?
Yeah, well, for instance, one of the ones I like is a young man who, for a bet, he decided to, he was drinking a glass of wine, and when he finished drinking his wine, he then ate the wine glass as well. So he just kind of cracked it with his teeth and swallowed the fragments. This falls into what I call a category of injuries you might call unbelievably stupid things done by young men. But the thing I really like about that case is that the doctor came up with this really ingenious way of treating him, because he realized that he couldn't let the glass just kind of work its way through the poor guy's intestines, because that would cause even worse injuries on the way through. And also he didn't want to make him vomit, because he thought that would probably result in lacerating the stomach lining. So this imaginative solution he came up with was to get this young man to swallow an enormous amount of cabbage. And his reasoning was that once the cabbage is in his stomach, the fragments of glass would kind of embed themselves in the bits of cabbage. And then having done that, he made the young man sick, and the cabbage bits came up with all the glass embedded inside it without doing him any further injury, which I thought was a really clever and sophisticated way of thinking through a problem of that kind.
You mentioned swallowing knives, and this also comes under the heading of something that a young man probably shouldn't do, made some bad decisions. There was a young man who, he drank a little bit too much, he decided that he could swallow knives, and he impressed his friends. In the long run, didn't turn out so well.
No, well, the interesting thing is the first time this happened to him, this is an American sailor who was in a ship that was moored somewhere in northern France, and they went ashore and they saw this stage magician doing this trick which involves pretending to swallow knives, and then back on board the ship he swallows a few knives, the entertainment of his friends. And then that's the end of it for several years. And then about 10 years later, he was on another ship and he bumps into one of his old shipmates who said, oh, can you do that knife swallowing trick for us? And he did, we are told, he swallowed up to 40 knives on a single occasion just to entertain his shipmate. And then he fell ill and ended up in hospital in London being treated by doctors who just didn't believe his story. He said he swallowed over a dozen knives and there was no evidence of this. They didn't believe him, and unfortunately he died. And to find out what had been wrong with him, they decided to do an autopsy on his body, and they found, to their astonishment, inside his stomach all the way down to his large intestine, there were the fragments, or intact, 37 knives. So he'd swallowed over three dozen knives.
He was drunk every time he did this?
I think on some occasions he was sober, but my guess is that the lifestyle of an American sailor in the early 19th century probably wasn't very sober.
Okay, then there is the woman who peed through her nose, which you're kind of doubtful of this, but this was a bizarre case. This sounds like something, and I think you mentioned in this book, from the movie The Exorcist. And again, I told our audience, some of this is cringeworthy, but the woman who peed through her nose, and other parts of her body as well.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story, and it was, in fact, the lead story. It was the main case in one of the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal, which later became the New England Journal of Medicine. Today, it's one of the best-known medical journals in the world. So this was a big medical story at the time. And she had started off with what were clearly a genuine complaint. She'd had a prolapsed uterus. This is very often a sequel, something that happens after childbirth. And that, in turn, had resulted in a prolapsed bladder. Again, a relatively common circumstance after childbirth. It's not gone terribly well. And this meant that she was unable to urinate naturally. And this leads, in some cases, to a condition where you basically get too much. It's called uremia. You end up with too many waste products in your blood. And the doctor claims that then the urine, which was unable to come out through the natural route, then starts appearing through her ears, her eyes, her nose. There's this one spectacular moment in the tale where there's a noise, the doctor says, as if a champagne cork had been popped. And then suddenly this fountain of urine appears from her navel. Now, this is just it is... In basic terms, an unbelievable tale. There's sort of no way this can have happened, surely. But actually, there are a couple of very rare conditions that together might have caused at least some of these symptoms.
Yeah, you were kind of doubtful in the book. You're kind of doubtful about this. So what are some of the conditions that could have caused this?
Well, there are two quite interesting ones, and these are perfectly genuine conditions. One is that a patient who has this, what I mentioned, this build-up of waste products in the blood, uremia, if it gets very extreme, there's a condition you get where the crystals of urea, this waste product, can kind of pass through the skin and appear on the skin. It's known as uremic frost. And if you sweat and you have uremic frost, the liquid that appears then as the crystals dissolve in your sweat is pretty much urine. It smells like urine. It looks like urine. So you can see how, say, some uremic frost combined with a bit of water might have given the appearance of urine appearing through her skin or even sort of running down from her eyes. There's also an unusual condition called patent uricus. Now, this is where there's a passage in the fetus in the womb. The urine passes from the bladder up to the umbilical cord through this passage called the uricus. And normally it disappears in the last trimester of pregnancy. But every so often, just occasionally, it can persist into adult life. So you can see there that if there was actually this passage up to her umbilicus, her navel, then just maybe a bit of urine came through her navel. So it may not be pure fiction.
Mm. We didn't even talk about the case that's in the title of the book. The case of the exploding teeth. What happened there?
Well, it's actually not that far from you. I think it's a case from Pennsylvania. It was a dentist from Springfield County had this case, which is almost exactly 200 years ago now. And the first example was a clergyman in middle age who developed this excruciating toothache one day, and there's this lovely description of him running up and down outside his house howling like a wild beast. And then the next morning, without any warning, his tooth just exploded spontaneously with what he described as a report that well nigh knocked me over. So he describes it in the manner of a sort of pistol shot or something like that. And there were several cases like this. There was another woman who was apparently deafened for some weeks afterwards after one of her teeth exploded in her mouth. And the interesting thing about it is what might have caused it. And the dentist at the time thought that it was just a sort of tooth decay that had caused the tooth to go bang. Now, we now know that doesn't happen. It's very difficult to explain. As far as I'm concerned, it is still a mystery. But there is a faint possibility that it might be something to do with the chemicals that were used in filling teeth at this period. So if you had two different fillings in your mouth and maybe one was using a different chemical from the other, they might just have reacted together and caused some sort of minor explosion.
But these people actually saw them as explosions, and the dentist at the time from Western Pennsylvania thought they were explosions too.
Yes, everybody concerned saw them as explosions. And in fact, the idea kind of resurfaced again about 100 years later in the mid-20th century, about 1960. One of the British dental journals kind of re-examined them, and all these other dentists came forward and said, oh, I used to use this particular amalgam in my fillings in 1910, and every so often it used to go off bang. So lots of dentists coming up with possible explanations, but nobody quite coming up with the silver bullet. Nobody quite explains it.
We only have about a minute or so left. This is fascinating. The book is fascinating, too. What would you call, you have, I don't know, maybe 50, 60, 75 stories, maybe even more than that. But what would you say is the most bizarre?
The most bizarre is, that's difficult to... it's difficult to choose one, really. I think some of the ones where people have recovered from these apparently, obviously fatal injuries. I think maybe the amphibious infant of Chicago is one of the most bizarre, although I suspect it never happened. But this was a man from Chicago who claimed that he had taught first his dog and then his infant child to swim underwater for 30 minutes at a time. And then there's this amazing report from a Chicago newspaper at the time where a journalist goes round and is introduced to this baby, which is then sort of popped in a tank of water and swims around happily underwater, picking up objects that his father chucks in for him to retrieve from the basin. So that's a very strange story, and I think the only explanation is it was made up.
Thomas Morris is author of the new book, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. Mr. Morris, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
not very often we get to talk to an author from overseas, from London, but that was interesting. The book is fascinating and interesting as well. Coming up on the program tomorrow, again, we have Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel. A lot going on when it comes to prisons, crime reform, a lot of things going on. So we'll be talking with Secretary Wetzel about that on tomorrow's show.